It is 5:01 p.m. and you're listening to WXYC Chapel Hill 89.3 FM. You're actually listening to the Global Music Show, a collaboration between UNC Chapel Hill Area Study Centers and WXYC 89.3 FM. Today our show is sponsored by the Global Center, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Nicholas Steiner. We're going to be talking about immigration and migration, and the title of the show is Keep On Moving, Music of Migration. All right, Nicholas, why would you say that migration is so controversial?
Well, let me first of all say thank you so much for having us on the show, the Center for Global Initiatives. It's great to be here. As you might remember, I'm back here for the first time in 20 years, having been a DJ here.
It's good to have you back.
Those of you who have been alums of the station would be happy to hear that the Donald Fagen and Partridge Family's posters and all those things are still pretty much the way they always were. So good to see the spirit is still there.
Some things never change.
About the controversial nature of immigration, I think partly has to do with the fact that it's just an enormously complicated issue. And the more complicated things are, I think the more controversial and emotional it becomes. One of the main reasons I think migration specifically has become so controversial is that really never before have people had the ability to move so easily from one place to another, while at the same time, never have governments had the ability to control this movement as well as they can. Now, of course, the control is not perfect because there is still a lot of illegal border crossing, but it is pretty significant what governments can do if they choose to control this movement. You think of the Berlin Wall as the best example of where a government got very serious about trying to impose border controls.
And are most governments real serious about that, like Berlin was, like the U.S. now? What is their border policy now?
Well, I guess that's really a question of the difference between rhetoric and actual policy, I think. In the rhetoric, you hear people talking about how the border is now being enforced and we're getting serious about it. We're building a 700-mile fence. I think in actuality, there are significant political elements in the United States that need and want immigration. They're vital to all kinds of economic interests. And so there is tremendous pressure in D.C. from both sides, those who want to control the border more and those who want a more open immigration policy.
Interesting. And I understand there's a difference between immigration and refugees, and we will be talking about that later in the show, right, Nicholas?
Yeah, that's an important difference that hinges to a significant extent on our perceived moral obligation to let people in. I think people widely accept that one has a moral obligation to let in refugees. Whereas immigrants are largely seen as being let in on pretty crass economic terms. If you need them, you let them in. If you don't, you don't. But that's an important distinction we can talk about later, yeah.
All right, well, we will be discussing that later in the show. But for right now, I'm going to put on some King Sunny Aid. And the song I'm going to play by him is called Iji Nilo Gaba Ara Mi, or something along those lines. And this is off of King Sunny Aid and his African Beats, Juju Music. You are listening to WXYC Chapel Hill.
Hey mama, yeah. I want to be mama, me, oh, can you look at me, oh, ebe, mobe, oh. Hey mama, yeah. In your love, fell in love, yeah.
Shiki, shiki, show me your baby. We'll be right back.
Hey,
You are listening to WXYC Chapel Hill 89.3 FM. It is 5:17 p.m. and you just heard the Klezmatics with NY Psycho Frelix off of Rhythm and Jews. And the Klezmatics are a group who blend traditional Jewish music with the more modern Western music, and that is particularly relevant to this show. This is the Global Music Show you're listening to, and we are talking about music of migration. And my guest with me is Nicholas Steiner from the Center for Global Initiatives. And we have been talking about immigration in general and other things like that, but we're going to go into more depth about immigration in this talk set. So, Nicholas, is there really a clear definition of an immigrant?
No, not really. That's an interesting difference between refugees, which we'll talk about in the next set. Refugees, there's the clear UNHCR definition put out by the United Nations. Immigrants, there really isn't a commonly understood definition of what it is. Most people just use it loosely to mean anyone who moves from one country to the next, usually for economic betterment. But they do tend to differentiate between, oftentimes between what they call high-skill and low-skill immigrants. I think that's a term we've all used. There are others who come along and say those are somewhat misleading terms, because low-skill immigrants can sound somewhat condescending. Some people prefer the term stress that, you know, even low-skilled workers are essential workers. That's why they're here. They're doing work that for some reason or another natives are no longer able or willing to do. And this is a phenomenon, of course, not only in the United States, but also in Western Europe, and for that matter, everywhere in the world. And I think that's what's an important thing to remember, these debates over migration, is that no country somehow has a monopoly on the problem. It is a truly global phenomenon, from the richest countries to the poorest countries.
So you think immigrants are necessary in countries today?
Or necessary?
Yeah, what do you think would happen if all the immigrants disappeared, per se?
I think there'd be widespread economic collapse, probably, because immigrants do, like I said, work that either natives are not able to do or are not willing to do at the given wages. Now, an interesting debate is, what would happen if, like you say, we suddenly got rid of all immigrants and asked native workers to start working in poultry plants or picking strawberries or doing that kind of low-skill wage jobs? Some people say, well, you know what, it's just a question of the wages are too low. Just if you raise the price, people start picking those fruits and slaughtering those animals. And others come along and say, no, they don't believe that's the case, that there's just certain attitudes that develop in wealthier societies that mark certain jobs as beneath them, basically. And so almost regardless of the wages, within reason, of course, that you would pay someone, you just wouldn't get people to do these jobs, and so that's why you have to bring in immigrants.
And what's the deal with immigrants and their families coming over? So I understand that can be a big issue sometimes.
That's a very big issue. That changed significantly in the mid-60s with the new Immigration Act, which started allowing much more family reunification, at least for the high-skilled immigrants. Low-skilled immigrants still have a pretty hard time bringing families under certain circumstances, especially when they're on temporary visas. And that brings up the whole issue of guest worker programs. And that's an interesting concept that I'm sure some of the listeners have heard of. These are programs that essentially bring in workers, but without wanting to really bring in people. In other words, you don't want the people to come and settle. You just need their work, and so you agree to bring them in for a year or two or three, at which point they're then supposed to leave again. And these were very common in Europe in the 50s and 60s. That's when they really started, and now they're widespread. They're used in the United States. They're used in the Gulf states. They're used in places like Singapore as well.
So would guest worker programs apply more to high-skilled immigrants or low-skilled, or...?
Tend to be for the low-skilled, because the high-skilled, you want them to settle. You want them permanently in your country. So, in fact, there's sort of a battle for talent out there, a global battle for talent. low skilled workers, it's there's a funny paradox where you basically need them, but you don't want them. So you need their labor, but you don't want them as people. Hence this idea that they're just guests. They will once again go home, but they largely fail. I mean, if you look at the guest worker programs in Europe, they really didn't go home again. They came to settle, and that's one of the big controversies in Europe today, is that they're starting to wake up to the fact that while they always insisted that they don't have immigrants, they only have guest workers, those guest workers have basically come to stay.
And how do guest workers go about staying in a country? Or don't the countries have certain policies that will force them to leave after a while, after they're unwanted?
That's exactly right. And you've got to be a government that is, you know, fairly ruthless in imposing these kind of returns. So places like Singapore or Kuwait or Dubai are very hard in enforcing the guest worker programs, and they're quite ruthless. You notice those are not terribly democratic societies. When democratic societies try to implement guest worker programs, they just start feeling kind of squeamish about it. They just don't feel quite right about being as draconian as they really ought to be in order to get people really to go home again, which is why ultimately I think in democratic societies, guest worker programs are going to tend to fail. They didn't work in Europe. There's talk about introducing them in the United States. I mean, they've been introduced in small scales, but if they want to introduce them in the large scale way that there's talk about doing, I don't think that's really going to work either.
So there are guest worker programs in the United States currently?
Yeah, they're H-2A and H-2B programs for farm workers. And that's the idea is, yeah, you get a permit to come work for a limited amount of time, usually a year or so. Then you're expected to go back again. But again, it's not that terribly difficult to overstay your visa and then slip into the underground.
Do you feel like the U.S. has targeted certain groups to incorporate them into the guest worker program?
They're largely Hispanics, largely from Mexico. And I think that's just a question of proximity, geographical proximity. It just wouldn't be very practical to have guest workers from, say, the Asian subcontinent.
Yeah. Okay, well, coming up, we have Richard and Linda Thompson with When I Get to the Border. And that is off of I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. And this song discusses some Richard Thompson's happiness when he gets to the border and feels a feeling of freedom, and as you will hear from the song. You are listening to the Global Music Show on WXYC Chapel Hill. Please keep on listening.
When I get to the bar,
You are listening to WXYC Chapel Hill 89.3 FM, and currently you're listening to the Global Music Show. It is titled Music of Migration, Keep on Moving. And my guest today is Nicholas Steiner from the Center for Global Initiatives. And the song you just heard was called I'm a Good Looking Cossack by Paulo Himanik. And that was off of King of the Ukrainian Fiddlers. And Paulo Himanik was from the Ukraine. He immigrated to New York and kept on playing his traditional music there and came to be known as King of the Ukrainian Fiddlers, as the release tells you. And previous to Paulo Himanik, we had William Capel playing Chopin's Mazurka, Op. 7, Number 2. And Chopin himself was actually a refugee, which we will understand more thoroughly after this talks with Nicholas. And Chopin was a refugee from Poland. He was forced to move into Eastern Europe and, well, Western, yeah, well, into France. I'll give you a specific country there, help you out. So yeah, he was forced to move to France after Poland was invaded by, or put under tighter control by the Russians. And anyway, before Chopin, we had Richard and Linda Thompson with When I Get to the Border was a song off of I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. And Richard Thompson was singing about the joy of getting to the border and that feeling of freedom that some immigrants undoubtedly have when they reach borders of other countries. But previously we were talking about immigrants, and now we're going to discuss refugees. And for immigrants, there wasn't a real clear definition that we could pin down as to what an immigrant was. But is that the case for refugees as well, Nicholas?
Well, at least in formal international law, there's a very well-recognized definition that's put out by the UN, the United Nations. That comes from the 1951 Refugee Convention. And it basically spells out a refugee to be anyone who's persecuted by their government for their religion, race, ethnicity, or nationality. Yeah, that seems pretty straightforward at first. But in fact, if you start thinking about that, you realize that's wonderfully controversial as well. Because first of all, the persecution has to be done by a government. But regrettably, there are all kinds of non-government actors out there who do all kinds of terrible things to people. Say a rebel group or a paramilitary group. Those, you know, narrowly defined will not be considered refugees if they're persecuted by those kind of people. But then what's also so important to that definition is what is left out. Noticeably, for example, gender's left out. Women in Saudi Arabia who, say, don't have the right to vote. Should that be considered a form of persecution and that we therefore have a moral obligation to let them in? Sexual orientation is also not in that formal definition, but regrettably we know that homosexuals face persecution both by government and non-government actors all over the world. And then there are things like, well, what about environmental grounds? If the government, say that the Chinese government that built that huge Three Gorge Dam project in China and dislocated millions of farmers. I mean, that was a government action that made people lose their home and have to move. Should those people, those farmers, be considered refugees?
But are they technically considered refugees by the definition that we have?
No, because governments tend to follow the UN definition because it's relatively narrow. As soon as you start opening up the definition, of course, you start having many, many more refugees. There are about roughly 10 million refugees around the world, according to this UNHCR definition. You know, if you start considering all the women who are persecuted for being women, or homosexuals, or the final thing I wanted to say is, how about just really extreme poverty? And of course, that's where the real rub in comes in with immigrants, because we tend to think, well, immigrants are just people who move for economic reasons. We really don't have a moral obligation to accept them. We have a moral obligation to accept refugees. But what about if you are forced to flee your home because of terrible government policies, economic policies that just keep you in extreme poverty? Well, you know, if you open the definition that broadly, which, you know, there's good moral reasons to perhaps do that, Of course, then suddenly you're talking about hundreds of millions of refugees worldwide. And that's just not really reasonable to expect the United States or a country where I'm from, Switzerland, to accept that kind of definition. So how do we actually define a refugee? That we have a moral obligation to accept persecuted people. Everyone accepts that. That's not really controversial. But what exactly constitutes a refugee? And for that matter, what exactly constitutes persecution versus just discrimination? Okay, so Saudi Arabian women are not allowed to drive. That's certainly discrimination. But is that significant enough to warrant the label persecution, and therefore we have an obligation to let them in? That's a tough call.
Yeah, where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
Hard to say.
And unfortunately, governments tend to draw the line too narrowly. They talk the talk, but they don't really walk the walk on refugee protection. You would never, as a liberal democracy, openly say, well, you know what, we're not going to accept refugees anymore. But they don't really do it as generously as I think they ought to be doing.
But if you don't define refugees as who they really are, then you can exclude them.
Right. Exactly.
So refugees... Are they allowed to return to their home country, or what's the issue with that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Sure, they're always allowed. Once you've accepted a refugee and given them asylum, they're pretty much in permanently, so they have no obligation to go home. But they're free to go whenever they want. Now, what happens often is that you don't really want to accept them permanently. You sort of want to give them some kind of temporary asylum. Say, look, We'll keep you safe until things settle down at home, and then you'll go back. Well, again, that sounds reasonable, but who exactly is going to determine when it's safe to go back? You know, the government at home says, oh, come on back, it's safe. Well, you got to be pretty wary of that. The country of asylum, I'm not sure, is always the best judge of when it's safe to go back, because they oftentimes have an incentive to send them home again. So does that mean you turn to someone like the United Nations or the Red Cross or Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch? Those are very important agencies in helping guide refugee protection, and because they tend to be much more sensitive and much more generous in who they consider refugees and who ought to be protected.
Yeah, I'm noticing a similarity between the asylum process and then the guest worker program. It seems like countries are inviting people to stay, but they don't really want to keep them permanently.
I guess like always, they're good refugees and bad refugees. Of course, everyone loves to have an Albert Einstein or an Andrei Sakharov walk in your door. You know, you're not going to turn them back. But when they're poor Tamils fleeing a bloody civil war in Sri Lanka, then it's you have qualms to not let them in, but you also really don't want them to just settle. And that's been very much the controversial issue over asylum in Europe for the last 20-25 years, is countries realize that situations in their home countries are bad, so that we can't send them back, but we don't really want them either. And so a lot of refugees, unfortunately, in Europe are in very much of a legal limbo. They're not really granted full asylum so they can settle in, but nor are they just shipped back home.
Now, is that the current stance of the United States?
The United States has it, in that sense, a bit easier, because it's much harder to reach the shores of the United States to ask for asylum. International law is very clear that if you reach a country and ask for asylum, that country has to at least listen to your refugee claim. In other words, And the claim is fascinating. If anyone's interested in this, I always assign this video in my class. It's called Well-Founded Fear. And it's just a fabulous documentary that shows exactly what the asylum process is like. And it really is pretty straightforward. I mean, you as a refugee come into the country and you make your pitch to someone who's sitting across the desk from you and say, I was persecuted at home and here's the documentation, here's my story. And then that person pretty much says, yes, I believe you, come on in. Or, no, I think actually you're lying. We're not going to give you asylum. Go back. It's a pretty harsh system. But it's hard to know what a better alternative would be, because there's got to be some kind of interview process or some kind of evaluation of an asylum claim or else it becomes meaningless if you just accept anyone who says, oh, I was persecuted at home.
Yeah, I guess it all comes down to where do you draw the line on all these issues.
That's exactly what it is. There are a lot of lines that need to be drawn, and where to draw them depends so much on your ideology, your political views, and it's just extremely controversial. But I think it's very important that we have these kind of conversations, because the more we talk about it, the deeper the conversations become. I think one of the great problems with certainly the immigration debate in the United States today is that it's just too simplistic and too superficial. We've got, on the one hand, the people say, oh, let's kick out all the illegals, let's build a high wall, and sort of the other side naively says, oh, kumbaya, let's hold hand, let them all in. Well, neither of those are terribly realistic propositions. We need to come up with a policy somewhere between those extremes. But where exactly that policy is going to rest is up for grabs.
Yeah, and once immigrants and refugees arrive in the country, the whole issue of citizenship comes up, which we will be discussing in the next talk set after I play something by Bob Marley, which is called Exodus, off of his release Exodus. And you are listening to the Global Music Show and being enlightened by Nicholas Steiner and myself, Neil Barnes.
And by Bob Marley, who this is probably the ultimate migration song right here.
Well said, Nicholas. Here's Bob Marley. Enjoy.
Exodus. When I was born, the midwife screamed and shouted, I have fire and brimstone coming out of my mouth. I'm at Soma, I'm the other na 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 na
na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na na that one with Mars.
I got the voices of many in my throat, the teeth of a frog and the tail of a goat. I'm Exoma, I'm the Elgin Man. Hey! Na-na-na-na-na-na. Na-na-na-na-na-na. Na-na-na-na-na-na.
Take that command of me,
oh, yeah.
And you make it come to me,
oh, yeah.
And she will love you,
oh, yeah.
All the time,
oh, yeah.
And when she got you running,
oh, yeah.
Got a train on a track,
oh, yeah.
You take some power,
oh, yeah.
And you make some pop,
oh, yeah.
That's gonna give you,
oh, yeah.
A sweat in your back,
oh, yeah.
I'm in coma, I'm the other.
With Pugamana, Hector Hippolyte. Oh, bear, oh, bear, oh, bear. Oh, bear, this me. I drank the water from the fiery sea. I'm in Soma. Creatures of the earth, they see a man. I'm at Soma, I'm the European man. I'm at Soma.
It is 5:56 p.m. and you're listening to WXYC Chapel Hill 89.3 FM. You are currently listening to the Global Music Show with our guest Nicholas Steiner from the Center for Global Initiatives. And we have been discussing and playing music of migration. And you just heard Exuma with the song Exuma, the Obia Man, off of his self-titled release. And Exuma was an immigrant from the Bahamas, and he immigrated into the United States, and you could probably hear the clash of culture there between his Bahamas roots and the United States music. And previous to Exuma, we had Bob Marley with Exodus, and that is off of his self-titled release Exodus. And I don't think I need to enlighten many of you about Bob Marley, so I will not do so. And previously, we have discussed immigrants and refugees, and now another important topic when speaking of migration is citizenship. And Nicholas, how does one acquire citizenship?
Well, in the 5 minutes that remain, there's sort of two fundamentally different ways you can get citizenship. One is called citizenship by birth, and the other is citizenship by blood. The U.S. follows the principle of citizenship by birth, which is very simple. If you're born in the United States, you're an American citizen. End of discussion. Citizenship by blood is found in many other countries around the world, and that's kind of a harder concept to grasp. But basically, in Switzerland, for example, which is where I'm from, you aren't a Swiss citizen unless you've got that Swissness in you, which is why that's considered citizenship by blood. I mean, it's that Swissness is innate in your blood, passed down through generations. And so if you're not Swiss but born in Switzerland, that's more or less irrelevant. They're not going to make you a Swiss citizen. Now, if you're not born as a citizen to a country, there is another way, of course, and that's the naturalization process. And most countries in the world have a process by which non-citizens in their adult life can apply to become citizens. And I'm in fact, a naturalized U.S. citizen. So it's an intriguing process. Basically, what it is a country gives you a test to see if you are one of them. And I did this about 10 years ago, and it was a very simple reading test and a writing test and a civics test. And luckily I passed, but it sort of made me wonder, you know, what is a reasonable expectation for we Americans to have of others for us to be able to say, okay, now you're American? And the Americans are quite generous in their citizenship, much more generous than, much more, it's much easier to get U.S. citizenship than many other countries. So it makes me wonder also, as I started researching this topic, you can ask yourself, well, why even have a test? I mean, you could say, you know, why not just say after a certain number of years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, if you're in this country, then you've sort of proven to us, we citizens who are already here, that you're serious about being here and being one of us, so we'll just automatically grant you citizenship.
Yeah, I guess if you live in a country for a certain amount of years and put up with the people in it, then I guess you could be considered a citizen. But currently the U.S. uses a citizenship test, a written test, and they say that determines whether you are an American or not?
Yeah, it's a written test. There's a writing test and a reading test and then an oral interview. And they ask me, for example, you know, what year was the Declaration of Independence signed and what are the three branches of government? Sort of basic civics questions. And those are fine, but you also wonder, well, but perhaps it's more important for a citizen to demonstrate his or her ability to get along in just everyday life. So maybe you should ask a citizen, and I'm not being facetious here, you know, and that is an iPod, or what's a Big Mac, or how do you fill out a check? Just sort of questions that demonstrate that they have a grasp of getting along in ordinary everyday life in America.
Yeah, I mean, it is great to know about the history of a country, but that doesn't necessarily constitute that you are keeping up with the modern aspects of that country, as you mentioned, such as iPods in the U.S. and Big Macs and other things like that.
Exactly, and the writing test that I took was also very interesting because it was literally the cat sat on the mat. I mean, it was perfectly simple for me, and it was almost a joke for me, but it wouldn't at all be a joke for someone coming from another country who really didn't speak English very well and perhaps was even illiterate in their own language. So, again, what kind of test do you give? Maybe you give different tests to different people, but, ooh, that's a slippery slope there, too, if you start giving, making that kind of differences.
Yeah, and so do you think citizens who are born, they have citizenship by birth, do you think they should be able to pass a citizenship test? Because I have a feeling somewhere out there in the United States, there's someone who is illiterate and would not be able to pass the test.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I think there are thousands, if not millions of Americans who would flunk that basic that naturalization test that I took. That's a very interesting question. But I guess there's not much we can do about it. I mean, there's no way we would require such a test of citizens to take, because after all, what would you do if they failed it? Strip them of citizenship? You know, you can't do that. At least, again, democracies can't do that.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, Nicholas, it's been a very interesting discussion on migration, and thank you for being here with me.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been good. And this is the end of the Global Music Show, and thanks for listening to the Global Music Show. And our next broadcast will be next Friday, and I believe it has something to do with South America. So if you're interested in that region, tune in. And to end the show, I'm going to play something by Gogol Bordello, and it's called Immigrant Punk, and talks about the attitudes that some immigrants face in other countries. You are listening to WXYC Chapel Hill, 89.3 FM. Thank you for listening.
Immigrant punk, emigrada, emigrada, emigrant punk, emigrant punk. Emigrant punk, emigrada, emigrada, emigrant punk, emigrant punk. Pow! Upon arriving to the melting pot, I get penciled in as a goddamn white. Now that I am categorized, officer gets me naturalized. Immigrant punk, immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Now that I'm living up in God knows where, sometimes it gets hard without a friend. It's hard, I am lurking around. Hossa, I see another immigrant punk. There is a little punk mafia everywhere you go. She is good to me and I'm good to her. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Despite the living in the USA, I'm still holding up in all my ways. I got a friend, we got a band, we still make sound. You can't stand without banging on some big old pot without getting out of bed. But I'm relaxed, I'm just lurking around. Hossa, I see another immigrant punk. There is a little punk like mafia everywhere you go. She is good to me and I'm good to her.
It's 6 o'clock and you're listening to WXYC Chapel Hill.
Party! You know, this singing sells the troubled soul. So I'm relaxed, I'm just lurking around. I got a method, and you don't. You got a dictionary kicking around. Look up the immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk. Punk, immigrant punk, immigrant punk.
immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk, immigrant, immigrant, immigrant pow. Immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk, immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk, immigrant, immigrant, immigrant punk.